Today's show is sponsored by Ting. Through the month of September, get a $50 promo code discount when you go to dancarlin.ting.com.
If he hasn't made you mad yet, he will. Common Sense with Dan Carlin.
Those of you who heard my last show 6 weeks ago know that by hearing this show when you're hearing it, I failed miserably in what I was trying to do. I was going to stay away and concentrate on the other podcast just to start, you know, whittling down this mountain of work that I have. And I couldn't stay away. I'd misjudged how weird it would feel to be out of touch for that long. And I appreciate all of your patience and indulgence and how great you guys have all been as I try to figure out the sweet spot in how you live a life and do all the things that you need to do and get out podcasts and keep up the quality. That's the one part I can't sacrifice. I can't bring myself to do something that isn't geared to be better than the last thing because I can't figure out what that even means. Even if you don't achieve it, that's got to be the goal from the outset, right? Otherwise, what are you thinking? I'll do something half as good as the thing I just released. You can't work that way. I can't work that way. So I'm working on figuring out things, and I appreciate your indulgence, and you've all been great, and I'm sorry it's been so long, and I know big things have been occurring while I've been gone. The biggest and the part that guilted me the most, because it was important and it was already on our list to talk about, and then it just blew up since the last show we did, was the situation involving refugees and migrants, two different words for two different things, coming from Africa and the Near East, across the Mediterranean and across, you know, Turkey into Europe, and causing a humanitarian nightmare. That's maybe a good way to put it. To not do a show when they found that two-year-old boy and that iconic photo, now iconic photo, was taken of the policeman on the shore picking up the two-year-old's body. And he's got, you know, there's little touches that make photos iconic, I think. And the little touch in this one was the policeman has these medical gloves on, these sterile medical gloves, to keep himself safe from any, you know, unexpected contamination or disease or whatever. But after he picks up the little boy, he can't help but sort of cradle him in his arms as though he's taking them to a crib to go to sleep for his nap or something. You know, you hear those stories and you see those iconic photos and your heart just bleeds, literally. I mean, you know, bleeding heart liberal. I mean, that's what happens. We all turn into that, I think. Those kind of photos move us. But at the same time, boy, what a problem. There are obvious similarities between the immigration situation going on in Europe and the situation on the southern border at the U.S., where, once again, it's become a political issue and the GOP presidential candidates led by Donald Trump are talking about it. And I thought maybe, I don't know if we'll get to some other stuff too, but I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about this today because I haven't dealt with it in a while. Just so you know what I think about the idea in general, I think it's an elemental force in human history, the fact that people move. And I don't think I need to convince you of this, right? I mean, population movement populated the planet. I mean, the Polynesians are populating the islands across the Pacific. If you believe in it, the Indo-European or the Proto-Indo-European invasions of the 3000s or 4000 BC, I mean, people move all the time. The entire history of the Eurasian steppe seems to be a domino effect of people forcing other people to move to new pastures, right? So history is almost driven like wind drives the climate, you know, by this movement of peoples. And we all do it. I mean, our ancestors have all done it. The funny thing is sometimes you'll hear a story where somebody will say, we tested the DNA of a man in Kent, and it turned out he was related to a skeleton from 1,000 years ago right down the street. So, in other words, implying that this man in Kent's ancestors have never moved in the last 1,000 years. It's a little different when you start talking about human migration over much longer periods. One of your number was nice enough not that long ago to send me a genealogy DNA test kit. What a thoughtful gift if you know what I would like. And thank you, by the way, if you're the one who did that. My daughter was also excited because she was working on a genealogy project in school. And she kept saying to me over and over again, Dad, exactly what percentage Irish are we? You know, and down the list, I'm a mongrel. And so, you know, I was getting, are we this percent German? How Swedish are we? And you just went down the list. And of course, I have no clue, right? That kind of math would bedevil me anyway. But I thought now that I have this kit, I'm going to scrape the inside of my cheek. I'm going to put it in that sterile test tube. I'm going to send it back with my secret code. And in 6 to 8 weeks, we're going to sit in front of the computer and find out those numbers to the last decimal point, which shows you that my mind was elsewhere because I wasn't thinking. When the results came back, it was like a map. And the map showed Africa mainly, with all these arrows coming out of it. And dates. And the dates are like Stone Age dates, caveman dates, practically, basically. Prehistory. Then you have this arrow out of Africa, you know, maybe stops in the Caucasus, leaves Africa 15,000 years ago, stops in the Caucasus for a few thousand years, and then moves on to Europe. I mean, it was that kind of thing where the minute you see it, you kind of go, okay, I get it. I wasn't thinking straight. DNA is not going to show me much from the era of nation states and modern peoples. It's going to show me the stuff from prehistory. And as you look at the map and you look at these giant macro trends over tens of thousands of years, I mean, you just notice people move. An elemental force, you know, making things happen. And one of the reasons you can see that it works that way is look at how in Europe it's forced events to move. I think it's a natural tendency among leaders and people even to give into whatever the prevailing inertia is on important subjects. I mean, in the United States, I talk about all the time, don't I, how likely it is the Congress, for example, or the president maybe, will kick the can down the road on some big important issue. Why should we wrestle with this? We'll let the next Congress, you know, deal with this tough, contentious issue. That's the normal state of behavior if we can get away with it. It's a little bit different when somebody bombs Pearl Harbor, or 9/11 happens, or 500,000 people show up at Europe's border and are dying on the way over and are starving and hungry and mad, and you have to do something. It's a decision point moment. Once again, this is why the population movement is such a reliable driver of historical things, because you have to respond. It forces action. In the year 375-376 AD, and some of you already know this story, it's one of my favorite immigration stories, and it actually happened in an area that it's kind of in the area that's having problems today, so there's some wonderful little parallels. Refugees from war showed up and ran up against the Roman border. The Roman Empire's border. The Roman Empire was the ultimate, shall we use the 20th century term, first world state. Sanitarily speaking, organizationally speaking, wealth and opportunity-wise, you name it. If you could get to the Roman Empire for any reason, it was probably a good thing for you. So a lot of migrants went there all the time, people looking for better jobs and all that kind of stuff, economic improvement. Maybe you could join the Roman army. A lot of Goths liked to do that. And it was Goths who had shown up to the Roman lines and quickly swelled in numbers, pleading. They were fleeing a terror that you know the name of. That's how terrifying it was, right? Talk about a reputation that lasts. The Goths were fleeing the Huns. The Huns were attacking them, and they had defeated them in a couple of battles, killed a king or two, and now these Gothic peoples were fleeing, and they ran up against the first solid object, which was the Roman border, and they wanted in. And they were desperate, and there were lots of them. Now, the Romans were pretty good at handling the immigration question. I mean, there was protocols, just like you'd have today, visas and things like that. But things got out of control. The traditional Roman history blames it on, you know, people on the ground, idiot underlings, but historians aren't sure. They think it might have been bad decisions by the emperor and his staff, and we're just trying to deflect blame. Nonetheless, here's the way historian Will Durant describes it, as taken from the original Roman sources, quote, "A Visigothic army met the advancing Huns at the Dniester and was overwhelmed. A remnant of the Visigoths begged permission of the Roman authorities on the Danube to cross the river and settle in Moesia and Thrace. The Emperor Valens sent word that they should be admitted on conditions that they surrender their arms and give up their youths as hostages. The Visigoths crossed and were shamelessly plundered by imperial officials and troops. Their girls and boys were enslaved by the amorous Romans, but after diligent bribery, the immigrants were allowed to keep their arms. Food was sold them at famine prices, so that hungry Goths gave 10 pounds of silver, or a slave, for a joint of meat or a loaf of bread. At last the Goths were forced to sell their children into bondage to escape starvation. When they showed signs of revolt, the Roman general invited their leader, Fritigern, to a banquet, plotting to kill him. Fritigern escaped and roused the desperate Goths to war. They pillaged, burned, and killed until almost all Thrace was laid waste by their hunger and their rage." End quote. People who are fans of Roman history know what's coming up next, because this population movement, this humanitarian refugee crisis, exploded into a battle that the Romans lost, called Adrianople or Hadrianopolis, and the Western Roman Empire was never the same. I've been watching video for a few days now, trying to really prep myself as best as an American can on some of these issues. And it's interesting because, you know, most of what you see are typical humanitarian crises and bad situations. But every now and then you see these videos where these, you know, refugees and migrants are obviously frustrated and have had enough and are to the boiling point. And any one of us who's traveled and had delayed flights and all these, I mean, you can see how it could happen. It's not that hard to imagine how something like this could happen in the situation those people have been put in. But the videos I saw, you know, with them kicking the fences down and starting to get kind of, you know, angry and violent about things, I thought to myself, what if they were armed? You turn them into the Goths, you know, trying to get into the Roman Empire. I mean, think about the difference there. In lots of eras, the people who were the immigrants or the migrants or the refugees had leaders and weapons. And the weapons were somewhat comparable to what they might face on the other side. Can you imagine? Refugees and immigrants and migrants with tanks. And it kind of sounds fanciful until you realize, wait a minute, there are tons of examples of armed migrant groups, you know, out there creating history. I love the period at the end of the Bronze Age, the collapse of the Bronze Age, around 1200 BCE, when a bunch of things probably conspired to work together to create all kinds of change. Shall we call it change? Is that a good way to put it? And the peoples of the sea and all those other potential migrant groups that played a role in that story. Or open up the Bible's Old Testament and read about, you know, the Hebrews 40 years in the desert wandering around. I mean, that's a migrant group, isn't it? But they're armed, and when they finally got to the, you know, promised land, as they called it, they were able to take parts of it for themselves. Another group of armed migrants, right? That the historical story of this is ever present and forever. Even when it's not particularly a military move, lots of people can get hurt just sort of by the very nature of so many human beings in motion. I mean, take, for example, the famous incident in 1947, 1948, when India, due to all kinds of problems, decided to partition part of its country off, split a piece off, and turn that into Pakistan. And when they did that, the people that wanted to live in Pakistan from India started heading there, and the people that wanted to live in India from Pakistan started heading there, and it may have been one of the largest human migrations ever. I mean, I think it was like 15 million or more in motion, and up to the high numbers I've seen are 1 million people may have died. Again, when that many people start moving, it becomes a historical force and a decision point that demands attention just because of the very scale. Scale is an issue in this problem that we're discussing today, too, because nobody has a problem with any of this if the numbers are much smaller. I mean, for example, Europe can easily handle a certain number of migrants and refugees coming across the Mediterranean or Turkey. They are doing so continually. If you're the, you know, Italian or Greek agencies responsible for processing these people, you can handle a certain amount, and no one even notices when that happens. It only becomes a problem when they come in such numbers that everything just gets overwhelmed, and then everything backs up, and then all these problems happen. And then a catch-22 arises on the scene, and the catch-22 is, if you do everything you can to help the people who are in trouble now, in transit now, actually sitting out there involved in this story now, what sort of incentives does that create for the people who are still back in the countries that these people came from and are wondering whether they should stay or leave? Anyone who wants to solve this specific problem is trying to figure out a way they can do so without making the overall problem worse. Because if Europe could handle, and if the United States could handle, and if other countries could handle this influx of refugees and manage to assimilate them nicely into their cultures, no muss, no fuss, what about the next wave of people? And what about the wave after that? And any idea that this is going to stop seems to go against, you know, almost obvious common sense historical forces here. I mean, doesn't it appear that there's almost like an osmosis thing happening when it comes to human migration? That it just makes sense that places that are currently better places to live would draw people from places that aren't? If you live in a safe, wealthy, prosperous, economic opportunity abounding sort of country where there hasn't been war in a long time and people are treated well, wouldn't that tend to attract people in some war-torn country where the raw sewage rolls down the middle of the street and war rolls over the neighborhoods periodically. I mean, that's almost like a natural process, isn't it? You can reliably depend on that force continuing. It would be strange if people didn't want to leave and weren't drawn to the new Rome or whatever, right? You'd do it too, wouldn't you? Once upon a time, most of our ancestors did. I was recently talking to a friend about this issue, and we marveled at how in 98% of the ways the world is getting closer together and more open and more integrated, the whole globalization phenomenon, right? And yet the one place where it's going in the other direction is with things like border controls and security. We all understand why that is, right? But he had brought up an interesting point, and we started to think about it a little bit. And he's of a very libertarian mindset, and his mind on states and nations is that all of that's a holdover from an earlier time period. And then if it's going to be a real 21st century globalized world, the idea of borders and countries should just go away. And so he was proposing that anybody be allowed to live anywhere, buy property anywhere, settle anywhere, no controls, no anything. And I have to admit, I've been thinking about that ever since. I mean, I can't get my mind around, and I have several different scenarios that I play with. I mean, if you do that, if you have some big day, you know, international open border proclamation day, and from here on forward, we're the EU on steroids, and what does the world look like 10 years from that date? There's a lot of possibilities, aren't there? Would we just see the people from all the countries that are not so great to live in move to all the countries that are perceived to be great to live in, and we just have these really populated areas that well, I mean, I can't even, this is what I mean, folks, I can't even imagine what that would mean. It's so foreign to our way of thinking. If I think of Germany, I think of a country populated by Germans. And so do the Germans, by the way, which brings up one of the issues that's fascinating in this whole question, and it has to do with assimilation. I'm looking at an online dictionary definition of assimilation right now, and it gives two definitions. And the first one says, to take in and incorporate as one's own, to absorb. The second one says, to bring into conformity with the customs, attitudes, etc. of a group, nation, or the like, adapt or adjust. And the example using the word that they give is, quote, to assimilate the new immigrants, end quote. When my daughter and I were doing that genealogy project, on my mom's side of the family, we could trace things back hundreds and hundreds of years. On my dad's side of the family, we didn't know my dad's grandparents' names. We didn't know anything about them other than the last names of his parents to go by, and we found nothing. I mean, you know, once you cross the Great Atlantic, a lot of the stuff from my dad's parents' lives just disappeared. But that's how they wanted it. My father said that his parents came over when they were tiny, 3 or 5 years old, I mean, really little kids, and their parents sent them across and they never saw their parents again. They never spoke to their parents again. And their goal was to be indistinguishable from other Americans. When they had kids born here, they named them the most, you know, Anglo-ish names they could think of. They took the names of British kings. I mean, one was Edward, the other was Richard. They never talked about where they were from. They never used their old language again. And when my dad or his brother would ask about it, they wouldn't talk about it. Their goal was to be indistinguishable from the rest of the people in the new country. And there are a lot of Americans, for example, today that said that the fact that that isn't done enough is part of the problem. 100 years ago, the official attitude of the United States on assimilation was a lot more like what my grandparents were trying to do, to cast off any old allegiances and to join the club, so to speak, and to not try to change things too much. After all, the people who were already here in the United States liked the way it was. You liked it enough to want to come here. Please don't change things too much, right? Try to fit in. Presidents like Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, who were both presidents at time periods where we had large influxes of people coming to the United States, both gave speeches about dual loyalty, for example, you know, having an allegiance to a country besides the United States, your old country. They denounced things like hyphenated Americans, which, by the way, just to show you how much times have changed, hyphenated Americans are the accepted way we do things now, right? Italian Americans, African Americans, Jewish Americans, you know, whatever it might be. That's, I mean, we've all gone exactly the way that the people 100 years ago worried we would go. A country that was balkanized as opposed to, you know, unified. I mean, all the 1940s, 1950s high school curricula, it's all designed to make good Americans of people from all over the place, right? Take from many into one. Turn you into good Americans. And good Americans speak English and they know the Constitution. And they know, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, there was a whole approach to transforming people from other lands into Americans. Now we are in a period where the attitude has changed and come around to the idea that with the many differences, we actually become stronger. The idea of diversity being our strength and seeing the country as the great melting pot, you know, the old line from a play, Once Upon a Time, viewing them as part of the myth of America. This idea that we incorporate all these, you know, people and we turn them into something better because we're unified, a mosaic, a quilt, whatever you want to, you know, use as a sort of a metaphor. But here's the thing, and this is what has to be understood, I think, when we talk about the Americans' way to handle things like immigration. A lot of it is simply human stuff. This myth of America that we're excited to take the world's poor and downtrodden and all those things yearning to breathe free, or that this great melting pot was ever particularly popular with regular people. Nobody, or very few people in very few time periods, have ever been very excited about accepting large numbers of people from elsewhere. Once again, this is a scale question too. I mean, you look at, let's pick on poor Denmark right now, because they're very nice people. And if you said to the Danes today, we have 100 Syrian refugees and they need a place to settle, I'm sure the Danes, and they may have already done this, I may just be behind the times, I'm sure that they, like the rest of these European countries, are taking people. I bet they would say, absolutely, sure, welcome them with open arms, you know, packages to help them get started. The Danes, very welcoming. But if you said we're going to drop 250,000 people from this starving area in Africa, let's just say, into Denmark, you're going to get a lot of those very welcoming, very, you know, liberal-friendly Danes up in arms about it. Because of the scale. Again, this is obvious stuff. I don't mean to throw the obvious at you, but it's important that we remember this because the United States is also a very friendly country to people from other lands. If you are an individual, or we're talking about a small group of people that's hardly noticeable, the United States is very welcoming. We won't speak your language. That's one thing that when you go to a place like Europe is rather embarrassing. All of these Europeans speak multiple languages. And you would think that, you know, as much as I talk about these things, I would. I'm embarrassed that I only speak my own. Nonetheless, as long as it's not a large group of people, the U.S. can be a very welcoming place. The problem happens when it is large groups of people, and it especially becomes disturbing to Americans. And this plays out in our political realm, by the way, when there are people who seem quite different than what's already here. In other words, we're afraid of the culture changing too much. The old line about we like the way it is. If you like the way it is, that's fine, but please don't change it too much. It's challenged by the idea that we celebrate diversity and every new group that comes here is to add their own little spice to the great melting pot stew. And eventually, for some Americans, it starts tasting a little bit more exotic than they're used to. But this is a long-running tradition in the United States. First of all, despite the way my grandparents wanted to be absorbed by the greater American culture, the idea of people living off in their own communities, reading their own national newspapers, sticking close to the news and the passions of the place that they left to come to the United States, that stuff is as old as the Republic, folks. And that's why you have places named Germantown. Or you might decide one day to go check out the furniture available for sale up in the beautiful Pennsylvania Dutch country. Multiple cities in the United States have Little Italies and Chinatowns, Irish and Jewish neighborhoods in a lot of older cities, and sometimes right next to each other, interestingly enough. People tend to self-segregate And a lot of times, you know, this was economic. I mean, you get a whole bunch of people just off the boat from the old country without a lot of money. Sometimes they all go to the poor neighborhoods together because that's what they can afford. One of the criticisms I hear about the situation in some of the European countries is that folks from elsewhere will congregate in their own communities. And then in those little communities, maybe in, you know, one section of Paris, you feel like you've gone into another country all of a sudden. And, you know, one of the things that people make a big deal out of, I saw a story and someone sent me a link to another one about, you know, this one part of Paris where supposedly if you walk around with a Jewish yarmulke on your head, you will not be safe because it's a little like walking around an Islamic country, which there are a lot of Islamic countries where Jewish people are safe. I didn't mean it that way. But my point is people will make this out to be some really unique and scary and different thing. It's another human thing. You don't think there are tons of stories, because there are, about the kids who get caught in the wrong neighborhood or have to go through, you know, you might be a Jewish kid who has to go through the Irish neighborhood and, well, we all know what could happen to you on the way home. Go look at West Side Story. I mean, this is just human stuff. My friend who thought that there should be no borders would be appalled by the idea that we would expect people, as the price of trying to have a better life or the price of trying to be safe or the price of trying to have food in your stomach or to be able to afford to raise your kids or whatever, that the price of that was that you have to give up everything that you are to go to the new place and become the way they are. Again, he's on a higher justice plane where he's thinking about, you know, the rights of the individual, but remember that they clash with the rights of other people. There's that wonderful line from Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes where he was trying to describe, and we've quoted this many times, the common sense limits of liberty. And he said, the right to swing my fist ends where the other man's nose begins. So the right of the newcomers to maintain who they are eventually, in large enough numbers, begins to clash with the rights of those who are already somewhere and who would like it to stay the same. There's nothing inherently wrong with that idea. It's unrealistic, but at the same time, it's a very human thing, and you don't have to go to immigration way at the international level to see the same dynamics at work. You can look at what's called in-migration, right? Movements within national borders. Here in the United States, for example, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, there was a mass, would you call it migration maybe, out of California. I was part of that, by the way. I came to Oregon. A lot of people also came to Washington. A lot of people came to Oregon. I should point that out. A lot of people came to Oregon. A lot of people came to Washington. A lot of people came to Arizona and New Mexico. The majority, actually, I think, went to Colorado. And all of those places were disrupted and changed. And it was not an experience many of the people who were already in those places were very positive about. In Oregon, there were signs, official signs, I think, put up by the state that said, you know, enjoy your time in Oregon, but please go home, things like that. That's not the exact wording of the sign, but it was something like that. Having a California license plate on your car up here was taking a chance for about a decade. So that same human dynamic of not wanting things to change. We like it the way it is. Don't come up here with all your California-cated ideas and everything. But here's the funny part about it, is that as much resistance as was, you know, occurring all those years, you look at all these places now, and I don't want to say they're all better, but at least here in Oregon, in these tinier communities, all of a sudden you saw the things that were important to Californians becoming priorities and the locals benefiting from that too. The restaurants got a whole lot nicer, for example. All of a sudden you had, you know, more attention paid to theater and the arts and all these things. I mean, you know, Eugene, Oregon, where I live, used to be really a timber town. A lot of Oregon was just really timber towns. And when you would come to visit, it had a very timber sort of feel to it. In the 1960s, this town became very one of the places where the counterculture was really strong, and they've always said up here that this is where the hippies ran away when the 60s were over and just sort of formed their own little enclave. Not a Jewish or Irish neighborhood, a hippie neighborhood, right? But if people came in here now, sort of a businessy kind of, you know, the California, Beverly Hills lawyer crowd decided, you know what, forget Aspen, it's getting very crowded. We love it up in the Eugene, Oregon area, and we're going to go hang out there more. And all of a sudden you started to get that kind of, I mean, the anti-hippie, sort of mentality. Don't you think the people up here would be like, wait a minute, you know, we don't mind you settling here, but this is how we like it. Don't change our counterculture ways. I mean, this is a standard human thing. So it's not surprising to see it involved in the question over things like migration. The reason I'm emphasizing this right now, you're saying, why are you spending all this time on it, Dan? Because these are the legitimate human reasons to be against something like this, because there are reasons that are not legitimate, and I'm going to get into them too. And you're probably thinking it's the missing part of the show already. It's racism, obviously, especially here in the United States. You cannot divorce the history of immigration and immigration law and all that from straight-up blatant racism. I mean, there's a certain wonderful honesty about the United States 100, 120, 130 years ago when it came to issues of race. They didn't think they needed to hide much. And so you get these really open debates, whereas now, if people really feel this way, they veil it in ways where you kind of have to penetrate this little smokescreen to see what they're really saying. 100 years ago, people had no problem saying, you know, we don't need any more yellow people here in the United States of America. Let's pass a law. You know, it's so overt that it actually seems to border on the comedic at times, which is the wrong feeling to have for something as serious as racism and people not being allowed to become citizens because of their skin color. All of that's very serious. But I keep thinking of like a Saturday Night Live skit where they've got these, you know, august judges and lawyers and everything, you know, debating whether or not a Hawaiian is a white person, seriously. And you just, you want to sit there and go, really? And that's just modern standards looking back. That's how people always are. At the same time, look at how race has been central to the entire question from the very beginning of who can become a U.S. citizen. In the 1790s, late 1780s, early 1790s, that's when they write the first of these naturalization acts that sets the standard for, you know, what you have to do or be to be naturalized as a U.S. citizen. We still have rules today. They're just different rules. In 1790, the rule that was mandated, among others, was that you must be a free white person. So that racial element is right in there in the law from the very beginning. And the reason it matters is because when you will have future court cases challenging who can and can't be a citizen or naturalized, they're going to refer back to, you know, the rules. And the rules had said, free white person, what do you want me to do? There's not a lot of leeway there. Unless, of course, you don't really know what the heck white is. That's the funny part of this. Again, this is the part you could see be a Saturday Night Live skit. By not really declaring what it is, they open up the door to court cases where people are saying, well, hey, I'm white. I was born in Japan and I look Japanese, but Japanese are white people. Over and over and over again. Again, it looks absurd. It was very serious. This is part of the history of racism in America, right? At the same time, let me read you just real quickly, just a few court cases that had to happen once. See, because once the Civil War happened, they added black people of African descent, you know, into the list, right? So now you have white people and black people of African descent. So what the courts initially said is, well, had they just left it white, they might have meant anybody. But once they put black in there, too, that clarified everything. So now if you're not white or black, you can't be made a citizen. So people started challenging this in court because, you know, Chinese folks, for example, we're having the devil of a time. They'd come to the United States, you know, at the start of the gold rush and afterwards in places like California. And then, you know, newspapers were printing it all up like it was the yellow peril coming, and local politicians, you know, made this a big issue. And you get things like the Chinese Exclusionary Act. So these people would go to court to say, listen, I should have legal standing. I should be able to be naturalized. There were thousands of these cases, by the way. And then the court was forced to consider the question, is this person white or not? And are people from where this person is from white or not? There was one in 1878, which is the landmark case, and it involved a Chinese guy who essentially challenged everything and basically said, I'm white. And they said, no, you're not. And they based it on, you know, things like what the Congress had intended when they wrote the law. They didn't mean to have Chinese people count as white, kind of. Common knowledge, that played a big role in a bunch of these early cases where people would just go, everybody knows Chinese people aren't white. And then, of course, this is the era where they're getting into the early kind of social Darwinist things where they explain eugenics and why some races are smarter and stronger and rule the world and others are always going to be, you know, I mean, it's that period in history. So they're trotting in the scientific evidence, too. after the Chinese are not white court cases came. Hawaiians challenged it. Not white, the court said. Burmese challenged it next. Not white, was the ruling. The Japanese then challenged, not white. They challenged several more times, not white, not white, not white. Didn't win any of those cases. Those were going up into the 1920s, by the way. Mexicans in 1897 ruled white, by the way. So an unexpected twist there that kind of is interesting considering today's questions at the south of the border. Nobody's getting white status, but in the Rodriguez case in 1897, Mexicans are white. Native Americans are not white, 1900 case. Asian Indians are probably not white. That's one of my favorite cases. That's where they're basically scratching their heads and going, I don't know. In what might be a surprise, for at least a couple of rulings, the courts of the early 1900s ruled Syrians to be white people. So the very people fleeing the war in Syria right now might have made it to naturalized citizens back by the, 1790 free white person standard. But in 1913 and twice in 1914, courts overruled that and took the white status away from the Syrians. Isn't this ridiculous? It's absurd. Like I said, I mean, you can't imagine. Ideas change so quickly. This is how it always is. These people back in this era that I'm kind of making fun of now would have had ideas from 100 years before their time that they could just laugh at the absurdity of. I mean, it's again, a human constant, and somebody will laugh at our ideas 100 years from now. Nonetheless, when you read it, it's hard not to think of it. I mean, it doesn't even look real. And it gets even sillier. Do you know who the real loophole in this whole free white person's thing turned out to be initially? The Irish. Bringing the Irish in as an example is a way to show that this isn't always about skin color, and it's tempting when you look at the historical record in the U.S. to think that it is. When in reality, I would suggest that skin color is just one of the things that made newcomers from, say, Asia, for example, seem different right off the bat. It's one major difference right there in front of your eyes. It's the many differences that I think people cared about the most, and you can see it when the period of Irish immigration in the middle 19th century spiked. And Americans freaked out about this. And the Irish were able to slip through that tiny little free white person's loophole because here they were, a group of people that the patrician northeastern Brahmins and the, southern landed gentry considered to be, the kind of people you didn't want in the United States. And yet, what could you do? They had white skin. Author of Barbarian Virtues, Matthew Fry Jacobson, has his little Irish intro. Say this, quote, "The idea of American citizenship, of course, was racialized at its core and at its inception. The significance and ramifications of the Free White Persons Clause of the 1790 Naturalization Act cannot be overestimated. Overtly tactical objections to incoming immigrants were advanced as early as the mid-century, when a consensus gradually formed as to the undesirability of the Irish, the first non-Anglo-Saxon group whose frightful numbers suggested a full-fledged political crisis for the receiving country. Couched in a racial language of Irishism or Celtism, the argument was put forward by patrician natives that the immigrants were constitutionally incapable of intelligent participation in the governance of the nation." That's a quote, by the way. "The Massachusetts State Board of Charities," he writes, "for example, identified the immigrants as, quote, inherited organic imperfection, vitiated constitution, or poor stock," end quote. Jacobson says, "as the chief cause of their pauperism and public dependency. In the wake of the Emancipation Proclamation, one writer in the Atlantic Monthly argued," Jacobson quotes him, quote, "it is impossible to name any standard of requisites for the full rights of citizenship which will give vote to the Celt and exclude the Negro," end quote. Let me stop there. Did you see what they just did there? They used black folks as sort of a measuring stick, for other people, basically saying, listen, if you're going to argue against black folks voting, I mean, how could you let these people vote? Matthew Jacobson continues, quote, "And in response to the Fenian raid on Canada in 1866, a fanciful Irish nationalist plot to free Ireland by drawing the United States into a war with Great Britain, the Atlantic Monthly again commented that, quote, All the qualities which go to make a Republican, in the true sense of the term, are wanting in the Irish nature. To the Celtic mind, when anything comes in the guise of a law, there's an accompanying seizure of moral paralysis. End quote. Jacobson then picks up another quote by the same author, quote, "A Celt lacks the solidity, the balance, the judgment, the moral staying power of the Anglo-Saxon," end quote. And then Jacobson ends up by saying, solidity, balance, judgment, and moral staying power, of course, representing the keystones of a self-governing republic, end quote. In other words, the Irish were either racially or culturally or both incapable of running an Anglo-Saxon political institution. You could use that same sort of excuse for a lot of different peoples, and we did. One of the justifications for keeping the Chinese out, for example, was that they couldn't be adapted to a republican form of government. They came from a culture and a mentality and, you know, all that stuff. As I said, if it weren't so darn serious, it sounds absurd by modern standards, doesn't it? All of it. History is funny that way. It's turning into a Quentin Tarantino film when you're seeing something awful that shouldn't be funny, and yet there's a tinge of funniness to it anyway, and it just feels wrong, like combining two foods that, you know, shouldn't be combined. Maple syrup and calamari, something like that. Somebody's going to try that and say it was fantastic, Dan. Nonetheless, the entire point of laying this out is that you can't discount racism as a reason some people are anti-immigration. And in the situation in Europe, I would suggest insufficient data on my part to make a determination, and I bet it would be different country to country. I think in the United States, when we're talking about, for example, the situation with immigration over our southern border, racism is definitely, you know, a component. I can't possibly say how much, but it is. And for those of you outside the United States who don't know what the demographic trends look like, for people who have a racial issue with Hispanics, for example, we're coming into a time in the United States where those people are going to be sorely challenged, because all demographic trends indicate that it will not be long before, I'm sorry to use these terms, folks, what do you want to say, Caucasians, white people, Anglos, there's no, you know what I mean. We're just going to be open about using terms here and just be clear. White people will be a minority in the United States. Now, what do you think about that? That's almost like an inkblot test, isn't it? Tell somebody, guess what, in 15 years, white people will be a minority in the United States. What do you think about that? And then get their first reaction out of their mouth, right? The people who are worried about that, I think, are the people who perhaps have an issue with immigration based on a racial reason. I saw a story in the newspaper the other day, and I think the story was actually played differently because I clicked around and read some local stories in Des Moines, Iowa, and there was a totally different spin on it. But the one that made the national news that I read was a story about the schools, the public schools in the city of Des Moines, Iowa, and how in I think it was in some districts, the numbers of minorities outweigh the numbers of white folks, right? And the underlying, you have to kind of read between the lines, but the underlying reason that story played and was headlined how it was and everything else was this implication that even in some of the most stereotypically white parts of America, their schools are majority minority. If it's like that in Iowa, what must it be like in some of the traditional, you know, diverse urban centers in the United States? It's almost a little bit of a fear story, and that's what kind of, you know, justified it to begin with. But you have to ask yourself, who's afraid of that and why? And my view on this, by the way, very unpopular. And again, why? But if I look at this historically, I look at the entire Americas as having a temporary spike, if you will, of Europeans. I mean, try to look at the history of the Americas instead of over the last 50 or 200 years. Instead, you know, broaden your lens out to 1,000 years. And imagine like a time-lapse camera showing the ethno-cultural, shall we say, makeup of the Americas. And you would start off with, again, pardon the very crude terms here, but you'll know what I mean, an essentially brown continent. Natives here, right? The peoples that were here when Columbus found the place, right? Or the Chinese found the place, or the Vikings found the place. Take your pick. They all ran into natives, right? And then quickly on your time-lapse camera, you would see the equivalent of what we're seeing into Europe right now in many big spikes where large chunks of human beings just came across the Atlantic and began to populate, you know, an area with a different ethno-culture than that which had been predominant here, maybe, you know, to caveman times. And there's nothing wrong with that in my mind. That's how history works. Are there tragedies? Do millions die? Do diseases spread? Yes. It's happened over and over and over again, right? Nothing inherently wrong with that in my mind. It's just the way it is. But here's the thing. The other thing that is the way it is that you were never likely to change a continent into a European, you know, country. You were not going to take the Americas and turn them into a Caucasian territory over the long haul, not unless you were having a very high birth rate. The demographics have determined that at some point the continent will regain its traditional majority, you know, ethno-cultural demographic. It's a brown continent. What are you going to do about that unless you're going to take active measures to, you know, retard that trend? And by the way, you know, this demographic situation is present in a number of our concerns. I mean, look at what Israel is dealing with and the thorny problems they've got concerning demographics and birth rate, with Palestinian demographics, you know, predicted to go in one direction and Israeli demographics another. And eventually you end up with a severe disparity, right? It's one of the reasons if you are a refugee or a migrant and you happen to be Jewish, the state of Israel is one of the places where you can go because they'd like some extra people to balance out demographic trends. In the United States, you would have to adopt measures that we won't do anymore. And I think because we are more advanced than in the era where we tried to have court cases on whether a Hawaiian was a white person or not, right? We've advanced. But what that means is we're not going to do these major efforts where we're going to throw people back across the border in large numbers. Pardon the use of what is now an ethnic slur, but it's a government name. In the 1950s, the Eisenhower administration conducted something called Operation Wetback. As I said, that's a derogatory term right now, but that's partially where it came from. And that was an effort that was designed to be, at least, a massive effort to throw people back across the border. So one U.S. effort over time has been to, you know, round up people and throw them back on the other side of the border. Another effort that has been popular for a long time is how can we make the border more secure, keep them from coming over in the first place? This is the category that Donald Trump's, you know, wall falls into. Same kind of an idea. And you've often heard people say that if we really wanted to make the border secure, we could, Dan, put the military on there, treat it like a war zone, have giant barbed wire fences that are electrified, landmine zones in the middle. I mean, you could do it if you want to. Apache helicopters patrolling the border. Here's the thing with that. And I mean, it's a popular thing to say because it sounds like you're finally, you know, turning everything up to 11 here on this immigration problem and taking it really seriously. But first of all, think about what it would cost you. That's the first thing that you kind of go, okay, you know, it's like having the army deployed at all times. The second thing is if we thought that picture of the little child who drowned in the Mediterranean on the way to Europe was so iconic and that moved so many people, imagine the photo that makes the rounds on the internet one day when some Hispanic family, you know, wife, children, you know, blows up in the U.S. planted landmine trying to come over the border. I mean, again, you have to imagine the backlash there. Our sensibilities, and I think rightly so, have outgrown an era where something like that, for most people, would be okay. Up till now, I think I've made this sound a little bit more like a conservative liberal issue, but I want to point out that part of what makes it so intriguing and also so difficult is that it's not. There are liberal arguments against immigration, and there are conservative arguments for it. On the liberal side, you know, one has to do with the effect that immigration, which usually consists of poorer people, right? People who are coming from a situation where they're starting at the bottom of the scale, trying to break into the system and make it at the ground floor. The problem is in most countries, there already is a ground floor, and those people have been trying to get ahead for a long time. When you throw a bunch more people into their pool, for example, their labor pool, it makes life harder on them. And one of the arguments that liberals have made for a long time is that, you know, you can never get the upward pressure on wages that you need for wages to go up, right? If the labor pool doesn't get scarce at some point. You know, when there's a lot of workers, wages go down. When there's not a lot of workers and the demand is high, wages go up. But what if the demand is never allowed to get high? Because as soon as you need more workers, you bring them from over the border. Now, the conservative pro-immigration stance comes from a lot of these people who want those people to come over the border for just that reason. For example, you look at the history of immigration law in this country as regards the southern border, the people that have always been on the pro-immigration side are the people on the other side of the border who want to hire them. Take agribusiness, for example. Right now, there are lots of seasonal workers who, under certain government programs, are allowed to come up and pick fruit, for example. Whenever this becomes an issue, you will hear the refrain from the agribusiness people that the reason that you have to import these workers from other countries is because they do the jobs that Americans won't do. And I always feel like they've left off the next phrase that has to be there to clarify that. The next phrase that has to be there to clarify that should be, at these wages. They do the jobs that Americans will not do at these wages. You pay Americans $15 an hour and throw in some benefits to pick fruit, you're going to have as many fruit pickers as you want. Now, here's why it's a complicated thing, though. These people who have these fruit companies sell a perishable commodity. They can't just put it in warehouses and hold it until they can reduce the demand. They have a limited lifespan, which is one of the arguments they have for why they need people right now to pick it. It's ripe, pick it. But it's also ripe, sell it. And as soon as it's not ripe, it doesn't sell anymore. And what if, because you're paying the wage that it takes to get domestic workers interested to pick fruit, which is not an easy job, the apples are $4 an apple? How many apples are you going to sell? In a sense, as has been said before, the entire low-priced fruit and vegetable industry is subsidized by a bunch of people who will work for wages that Americans will not work for. And yet at the same time, when you look at it as a whole situation, you kind of go, well, God, there's injustice everywhere in this deal, but you can kind of understand how it got to be the way it is. And maybe in that sense, you could almost, if you wanted to portray it this way, and I bet my libertarian friend would, the entire system, including the use of public funds by people who are, you know, coming over the border undocumented, you know, you'll often hear that refrain that they're using taxpayer money for welfare and medical and all that. You could maybe look at all of that as an entire taxpayer-funded subsidy to keep, you know, the cost of goods and services low. Because whereas if you send all those people back home, you might save some money at the food stamp line by not giving folks who don't belong in this country legally, you know, bottom line help. But what if you end up paying so much more for the hamburger that now requires somebody, you know, to make $15 an hour, or the apple that costs $4, or whatever it might be? Do you end up spending about the same amount of money? Is it a wash, I guess is what I'm saying? I don't know. It shows you, though, the incredible interconnectedness of this issue and the timelessness of it. In the era of terrorism, obviously, you have perhaps some unusual wrinkles now in the debate where you can talk about, for example, in Europe, these people coming from some of these countries where there are going to be included amongst any large group of immigrants people of a radicalized sort of political temperament. Look at the conditions they came from, right? Pretty hard to imagine that you would have a whole bunch of people who were not very passionate and radicalized. So people worry about letting large groups of people in where small groups of people, you know, that might be terrorists or sympathizers can get in with them. Those are understandable concerns. Other people are concerned about building up sort of pockets of communities where radicalism might breed in your midst. When we used the Paris example earlier, I mean, so you bring a bunch of people, say, from Syria into Paris, and over time, a generation from now, you have 1% of a radicalized community within Paris who are radical sympathizers. I mean, I think those are logical concerns also. And by the way, not exactly new, because, you know, in the 1980s, we were all worried about people bringing drugs and guns and Mexican gangs over the border. Of course, we found out the guns were often going in the other direction. When my grandparents were coming over, the big worry at the late 1800s, early 1900s was anarchists. And again, legitimately in one sense, I mean, anarchists had been, you know, planting bombs sometimes and people were killed. Heads of state had been assassinated, but for a while, there were questions that people got asked when they wanted to immigrate to the United States, and people would say, okay, what are your leanings about government? Do you think government has a role in things? I mean, they were trying to suss out any potential anarchists. And one of the arguments for limiting the immigration from places like Eastern Europe and especially Russia was, well, you know, Russia, they have a lot of anarchists over there, breeds anarchism. So this idea that amongst the people that are coming over are going to be dangerous people. That's, again, the oldest argument in the book. When Donald Trump talks about the, what did he say, that they're not, we're not getting the best of Mexico or the people south of the border, we're getting their rapists and their drug dealers or whatever he said. And people get mad at me when I misquote people, but if I'm doing it from memory, you know this, go listen to his exact words, right? And truthfully, what he says to a degree is right. We are getting rapists and we are getting drug dealers and we are getting criminals, but in any large group of people, you're going to. Nonetheless, the real interesting thing, and people who have met and who deal with people from south of the border a lot already know this, we're actually getting most of the best of the people from places like Mexico and Honduras and Guatemala, amongst other places. And you know why? Because they're the people that are so willing to change their life circumstances and are so willing to put in the effort and the trouble and take the risks that they do what many of our ancestors had to do once upon a time too, and strike out on an endeavor, one with no guaranteed amount of success, and one that will require tons of hard backbreaking work, but that you do to improve your own standing of life and to give a better life to the next generation. Aren't those the very American ethics that were argued were so important 150 years ago and 100 years ago that we had to keep other people from other countries out because they didn't have these qualities and they would pollute the pool here in this country of real Americans who did possess those qualities? I know a guy who owns a fast food restaurant who will only hire Hispanics. And I think it's legal Hispanics, but his point is that the work ethic of our own native-born kids is not what it used to be or what it should be. He talks about, you know, training new people who get hired out of high school, who then the first chance they get to backpack across Europe, you know, decide to drop the job and go do that. And here's the funny thing. As an American, I'm thinking, well, gosh, I wouldn't miss out on a backpack trip to Europe at that age either. That's what you do at that age. But his point is, not if you're one of these Hispanic workers that they hire. He says these are people who take the job so seriously and value it, and because of that, they do it differently and they treat it differently. In a funny way, you know, in the 21st century, you can't justifiably, and of course I think, you know, rightly so, you can't make a justifiable argument that somehow we need to maybe import more Scandinavians into the U.S. than these other peoples to sort of reestablish the demographic dominance that Caucasians used to have. In other words, you can't say we need more white people in this country, so let's bring more white people and less people of other color. That's a 19th century mentality that goes along with those kind of court cases we mentioned earlier. Sounds absurd and racist to the core to talk about that. But, you know, maybe you could make a case that with a lot of these immigrants, we are importing people who are reinfusing the old American Protestant work ethic back into our culture, because some of the hardest working people in America right now are people whose ancestors not that long ago came from the kind of places that, you know, we were having immigration laws passed to keep them out of this country. Asian Americans making huge contributions. The people that came over, famously Castro's boat people, who, you know, so famously was supposed to consist of all these Tony Montanas and these drug types and the people from the prisons, they've made a huge contribution to the country since then. Hispanic Americans go back so far, they predate the Anglos, obviously. Go to some of these places like Southern California and try to find your way around La Cienega in Los Angeles, over by El Segundo, down by Yorba Linda. I mean, you know, I mean, it's a reminder every day as you're going down Cahuenga, you know, who the heck was there first and what the natural balance of the place is probably supposed to be. But, you know, to get back to the European situation, too, I saw an article today in the paper that talked about, you know, the various positions that different European nation states have on taking some of these immigrants. I guess there's an agreement the EU is going to divvy up now some of these refugees and migrants to various, you know, European countries, and everybody's going to have to take their share. And some of these countries are adamantly against this. And many of these democracies, and this is another interesting question too about democracy, it seems like public opinion is with their governments who don't want to take any of these refugees. What do you do in a free country if the government is supposed to do what the population wants and the population doesn't want to help out any more refugees or migrants? It's a really vexing issue, isn't it? And when you talk about ways to solve this problem, it's a perpetual problem that's never going away. So how do you solve an ongoing you know, thing, the movements of peoples because of these almost physical laws of nature. I mean, you can have what I like to call the NAFTA justification, which, you know, I don't think was ever really a justification, but one of the ways they tried to sell a trade deal, a North American free trade deal in the 1990s to the American people who were wondering what was in it for them was the idea that you would create more economic opportunity south of the border, and that would equalize conditions somewhat so that that osmosis sort of process was mitigated. In other words, you know, when do things stop flowing between two unequal spaces? When you achieve a stasis, a balance. I mean, if people in Mexico have as much opportunity and the wages are as high there or the lifestyles are as good there as they are north of the border, theoretically, there'd be no reason for people to come over. You will have short-circuited that natural process. While that makes total logical sense, can you imagine what it might take to achieve something like that? One doesn't have to imagine very much to think that it might be a worse situation than the problem we're trying to solve. Now, the European situation is quite a bit different from the one in the U.S., because the one in the U.S. is overwhelmingly about migrants, people who are seeking a better life. It also involves a lot of people who go back and forth over the border. It's a permeable area where people who come to the United States to work often go back to visit families or loved ones, and money goes back and forth. There's a lot of transfer and a lot of traffic back and forth. In Europe, a lot of these people who are coming from these areas that, you know, they're seeking either better lives as migrants or fleeing, you know, terrible dangers as refugees, they're coming to stay. That's a little bit different. The other thing that changes is that because they're part of a temporary spike in the numbers of migrants and refugees, that situation, while I think it's pretty permanent, can be mitigated for a while. So this temporary crisis can be alleviated perhaps with more stability in North Africa, as hopefully that starts to develop over time. You'll see numbers drop down then. And also, you know, East Africa's got some problems and is contributing to a number of people showing up to North Africa to cross the Mediterranean. You'd like to see the situation in Syria get less violent and less scary. The Turks, by the way, spending billions and billions of dollars on refugee camps over there for the most threatened Syrian population. I saw a virtual reality program a while ago that gives you a virtual reality tour of some of those camps. And while it's fantastic that there's some place, and you know, I favor all that stuff, I always want to have refugees have a place, a safe haven where they can be, you know, out of the line of fire, it's no place you'd want to raise your children. How long could you stay in one of those refugee camps before you started to think, you know, I've got kids growing up here whose only memories are going to be in a place like this. How long until you, as a parent, would decide to strike out for something better, even if it was illegal, even if you knew you were breaking the laws? At what point is the equivalent of stealing bread to keep your children alive no longer, you know, theft? So efforts to mitigate the ground zero crises that make these people want to take the chance to get to Europe anyway are good ideas, but they're not going to stop the flow entirely, and they're not going to be permanent. That old line that Jesus is supposed to have said, there will be poor always. There also will be refugees fleeing war always. And, you know, whenever I think about this, I just think of that, you know, famous line, there but for the grace of God go I. I also think of a punk song by Richard Hell when he said, when you're born, that it's such a gamble when you get a face. Any of us could have been born to good parents or bad parents, into wealthy homes or into poverty, into rich, prosperous, safe countries, or poor, frightfully dangerous, you know, nations. It's sort of the luck of the draw that we're in the countries that are complaining about the people coming over, as opposed to being born in the countries those people are coming from. If you're unhappy with your current cell phone service, or you are considering adding an extra line or an additional line and you don't want to pay the same price as you're paying with your current cell phone service, consider switching to Ting. Ting is mobile service made easy. We've been telling you about them for some time now here on the program, and it's a great way to cut your cell phone bill down if you're unhappy with what you're currently paying. Ting on their website has a calculator to help you figure out whether or not switching to Ting would save you money. Nowadays, more than 80% of the cell phones out there will work on Ting service. And if you're locked into some deal with the company you already have and you're thinking, God, I'd like to switch, but I'm not sure I want to pay the fee to get out of my deal, Ting can even help you with that. They have a program to give you some money to help you break your existing contract, and they won't sign you up for another one. Ting doesn't do any of those contracts, and they only charge you for the services that you use. If you're not sure what those are, Ting has a powerful online account control panel that will help you figure it out. There are no overage charges or penalties, though. I can save you the suspense there. No add-on charges, no mysterious line items on your bill, unlimited devices on one plan. And if you act before the month of September is over, you can get a $50 promo code discount or credit when you go to dancarlin.ting.com. If you're not sure, why don't you head on over to ting.com? Use their tools to find out if you could save money and better manage your mobile service using Ting. Go to dancarlin.ting.com, as I said, in the month of September. Get a $50 promo code credit or discount.
If you think the show you just heard is worth a dollar, Dan and Ben would love to have it. For less than the price of a cup of coffee, you can help keep the common sense coming. A buck a show. It's all we ask. Go to dancarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.